There's right and there's wrong. Ask anyone, and they'll probably tell you the lines are clearly drawn. But ethics evolve over time. And in fact, technology is accelerating that change. So says Juan Enriquez. He's a co-founder and investor in companies on the cutting edge of biology and technology. And he looks back at the ways our thinking about issues like slavery and gay marriage have evolved, and the role that technology plays in those shifts. At a time when so many are polarized over their own versions of what is right, he suggests forgiveness and humility in his new book, Right Wrong: How Technology Transforms Our Ethics. And Juan Enriquez joins me now. Hello there.
How are you?
I'm great. Why did you feel the need to write this book?
So I have been working on how life is coded. So in the same way as you can write books using different alphabets, or you can write computer programs or music or photographs using ones and zeros, we've learned how to code life, and first how to read the gene code of life and genomes. And then we learned how to write those genomes and how to do synthetic biology. And now we're learning how to understand and map the brain and how to perhaps even alter thoughts, erase them, or induce them. And that led me to spend a few years thinking about, boy, what's right, what's wrong, what's ethical, what's not. And that's how this book started.
Cancel culture plays a big part in the chat around this book. Is cancel culture a byproduct of the belief that there is only one right?
So you have to separate this thing out. We've done a lot of boneheaded things as human beings, and we've had a lot of beliefs that have fundamentally changed. So if, you know, you were living in Tenochtitlan under Aztec times, it was normal and natural to take some poor schlub up to the top of the pyramid and rip his heart out with an obsidian knife. And otherwise the sun wouldn't rise and the rains wouldn't come. It was normal and natural not that long ago in the fanciest squares of Paris to wheel up a guillotine and watch some poor schlub get his head cut off, and then they'd exhibit the full head to all the families that had come to enjoy the spectacle. And so we've learned over time how to become, I think, more ethical. It's not a straight line. It's not something that happens automatically. But on the whole, in the world, there's a lot less violence. There's a lot less slavery. There's a lot less child labor. And I think when you judge the past, you can't justify what they were doing. But you also have to understand that the meaning of particular words and actions can change over time. That we have gotten, I think, better at recognizing right and wrong. And that is not a process that's finished. And that there's a lot of things that we're doing today that are going to be considered barbaric in a few generations.
One way of thinking about it is that there is only one right, and we're progressing towards it. Some people might believe, people on Twitter might believe, that we've already got there. We know it all now. Do you see it as a progression towards this objective agreement on right and wrong?
So most religions throughout history have sold that idea, and many governments have. And they have been some of the most violent and repressive organizations that we've ever seen, because it was my way, or I will torture you to death, or I will burn you at the stake. And the consequences for religions when they take an absolutist fundamentalist position, or for people in government when they do that, is that often they become extinct. So 99% of the religions in the world that were advocating, I am 100% right and I will never change, went extinct. And that's why when you go to the great museums of the world, you are mostly looking at dead gods. You're looking at Zeus, you're looking at Neptune, you're looking at Quetzalcoatl, you're looking at the god of rain, you're looking at XYZ that people thought was the be all and end all of right. And it turned out not to be true. And that's why the two words you mentioned, humility and forgiveness, are so important during a period of such polarization, certainty, and judgment as we're living today.
You say that we've got better at making ethical decisions. Is the idea of ethics woven into our lives enough, or has that whole sort of discipline become too academic?
So I think you're exactly on the right question. Most people hear the word ethics and they think about one of the most boring single books ever written, which is the HR manual that you get when you join a company, or the code of ethics that you get when you go to college. And look, those are books written by Captain Obvious. If you don't know those principles already by the time you get to your job, by the time you get to your college, you don't deserve to be working alongside these nice people. That's not where ethics gets interesting and complicated. Ethics gets interesting and complicated when technology allows us to do things we've never done before and fundamentally changes the rules. So let me give you an example. We still burn a lot of fossil fuels. It's almost impossible to leave New Zealand without burning a lot of fossil fuels. And yet, wind and solar and geothermal, the cost curves on those are coming down so quickly that pretty soon it's going to be cheaper to use any one of those than coal, than oil, and then eventually gas. And once that happens, future generations are going to say, how dare all of you have warmed up the planet, have emitted so much CO2, because they will have the option of having more, faster, better, cheaper energy without having to change their lifestyles. And so much in the same way as we condemn, justifiably, people who lit their houses with whale oil, people are going to look at us and say, boy, those people were primitive. And we're going to be judged because technology will change the rules.
Yeah, you write that we are in an age of exponentially changing technologies, ergo, we are in an age of exponentially changing ethics. Why does the one follow the other?
Well, you have to assume three things. The first thing you have to grant is that ethics changes over time. And there's a lot of reasons to be angry today and to despair and to feel like things just aren't getting better. But if you think about being born at random as somebody from an indigenous population 100 years ago, or as a woman 100 years ago, or as a person of color, or as an immigrant 100 years ago, likely you would be treated better today than 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 500 years ago. So our treatment of each other, our ethics, our respect for people who have different sexuality or different race or different, backgrounds, I think has gotten better. The second point is one of the reasons it's gotten better is because technology keeps changing the goalposts on what we can do and what we see and how we treat each other. It's very hard to treat people who are of a different sexual orientation as the other once you start seeing them in films, once you start seeing them in theater, once they start coming out of the closet. And they become part of your community and a very vibrant and important part of your community. And then the third thing is technology is moving so quickly that it's giving us options to be more generous without having to oppress others. And we have more choices than people had 1,000 years ago.
Is there any North Star, any fixed position that guides how we should behave that doesn't alter with time?
I don't think it's an arithmetic calculation, 2 and 2 equals the right behavior. I think it's more like you know, those calculations that you kept having in calculus where you kept getting closer and closer to the curve, or like fractals where you get closer and closer and then another fractal appears and then another fractal appears. And I think ethics is like that. And I think, you know, as long as we keep thinking, would I want to be treated that way? Is it just for me to treat that person? Would it be just for that person to treat me this way if we were in flip positions? I think that's what one of these calculus curves looks like. And I think that's what most people and religions and ethicists preach over time.
I'm speaking with Juan Enriquez, co-founder and investors in companies on the cutting edge of biology and technology. And we're talking about ethics and how technology can affect them or has affected them. His new book is called Right/Wrong, How Technology Transforms Our Ethics. When you talk about how things used to be, I mean, let's take slavery. This is a pretty good example. Is it possible that people didn't think slavery was right at the time? They knew it was wrong, but did it anyway because they had the power to do so. Is it letting them off the hook a little to say that they just had a different belief system?
I think there were certainly people who understood that slavery was wrong. I think there have been abolitionists and very brave people who've opposed slavery for a long time. But I don't think the majority opinion was there. And so what's interesting about slavery is, one, every person listening to this knows slavery is wrong. Every person listening to this knows that you should not have indentured servants, that you should not have slaves, that you should not treat people like goods. There just isn't anybody listening to this that wouldn't agree with that statement. So if that is true, then the question becomes, why did so many civilizations, the Incas, the Mayas, the Chinese, the Greeks, the Indians, the Americans, the Brits, the Spaniards, the Italians, you name it, why did they all think slavery was okay? Why did they tolerate it legally for so many millennia? Because this isn't a phenomenon of one country, this isn't a phenomenon of one culture, and this isn't a phenomenon of one century. This is a phenomenon that goes on across almost all of human history. So why did everybody tolerate it? Why did everybody legalize it? And then I think the second question, which is a really important question, is why did it go away in a relatively short period of time on a legal basis? I understand there are still slaves today. But legally, most countries in the world did away with this in a relatively short period of time. And I think the answer has to do a lot with technology. I don't think it's a complete coincidence that in addition to having very brave abolitionists who spoke out and put their lives on the line, slavery began to go away when you started burning fossil fuels. Because each barrel of oil contains about 5 to 10 years equivalent of human labor. And when you tie that to thousands of horsepower, when you have the Industrial Revolution, all of a sudden you have the equivalent of tens of thousands of people labor at your disposal. And you can actually quantify that. When you fly out of New Zealand, if you're on one of these new two-engine planes, remember those old Viking ships where somebody would sit up at the front banging on the drum, and every time he banged, you were supposed to pull the oar?
Yeah.
Well, when you fly out of New Zealand and it takes you across the Pacific, it's the equivalent of having 320,000 people rowing you across the Pacific. That's the energy involved. And when you have that energy at your disposal, then you can have a whole lot more and not oppress people in the way in which we did for tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years, which in no way justifies oppressing people, in no way justifies owning another human being. It is absolutely wrong. But something that was absolutely wrong was tolerated for hundreds of thousands of years to the point where everybody who lived north of the Nordic countries is called a Slav, S-L-A-V, which is shorthand for slave, because that was simply a population that it was your right to go down and, you know, enslave if you were a Viking or if you were one of these raiders.
You seem to be suggesting that people can't, societies can't or won't change their ethical viewpoint until it's convenient or advantageous, pragmatically advantageous for them to do so.
I think there is a bell curve, and there will always be people who will fight against injustice at the price of being burned at the stake, at the price of being tortured. There are always incredibly brave souls who are at the beginning of that curve. But the majority opinion is unlikely to change until you have a substantially different environment or you have alternatives. And you can see this happen very quickly. In the United States in 1996, two-thirds of the United States was against gay marriage. Today, more than two-thirds is for gay marriage. The Pope, the year before he became the current Pope, he argued that this was, you know, any kind of civil union among same sex was against God's plan and an abomination. About a year into this becoming Pope, it's that famous phrase, who am I to judge? Last year, it's, I'm in favor of this. And by the way, he said that being incredibly brave, because a whole lot of his hierarchy and a whole lot of his flock was not ready to go there. So he was ahead of the curve. So I guess in answer to your point, there are always people who will act out, act up, no matter what the consequences. But that's not the case of the majority until there's an alternative. And you can see that, for instance, in meat consumption. So the first synthetic hamburger in 2013 cost about $300,000. Two and a half years later, it was $30. Last week over here, it was about $7 to $8. And so as you get faster, better, cheaper meat that doesn't require caging and slaughtering an animal, the majority that has not become vegetarian may become vegetarian in a relatively short period of time because they have an alternative. And looking back in retrospect, our animal husbandry practices may not look as justifiable or as cute.
Do you look at slave owners and bigots of the past with the humility and forgiveness that you counsel us to look at each other with in 2021?
That's a really difficult question.
I'm sorry.
No. And it's absolutely justified. And I wrestle with that question. And I think one of the things we have to do is recognize that what they did is in no way justifiable. It is also true that in the context of their time, there were people who acted like monsters and people who, in the context of their time, were not acting like monsters. And I think somebody like Thomas Jefferson, who freed the kids he had with a slave, is a different person. Benjamin Franklin, who tried to put the abolition of slavery into the Constitution, even though he later owned slaves, is in a different category than somebody who systematically went and raped slaves on their wedding night and loved to beat them because he was a sadist. And part of the issue you have these days in our polarized era is you and I can seriously disagree with a lot of people. But if you say 49% of the people over here are pedophiles, baby killers, bigots, cancel culturalists, this, that, or the other, what you're doing is you're dehumanizing people and you're saying, that 49% are not decent human beings who were trying to do the right thing in the way in which they understand it or were brought up or that they have learned from their peers or whatever. And the consequence of doing that is that the 1 or 2% of the population that truly are sociopaths, psychopaths, sadists, just horrendous human beings, have an umbrella where they can sit underneath that and say, we're all the same. They're attacking all of us. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a thing where you have to cull the evil and point out the evil, as opposed to creating very large groups of people that you stereotype as anyone who is on that side is evil.
How do you think the people in the future will think of us?
Oh, God help us if they judge us in the same way as we judge people 100 or 200 years ago. Because part of the issue and part of what's happened is if you think of the most famous and scrutinized figures in history, a Henry VIII or a, you know, a famous explorer, a famous movie star, whatever, you know a lot about their lives because of their letters, because of people who wrote about them, because of XYZ. But it is nothing compared to the density of the data file that's available to a future generation on each of us. Because Facebook and Twitter and our credit cards and our toll receipts, everything is an electronic tattoo. And in the same ways, you can tell a whole lot about a person by what that person chooses to put permanently on their skin. You're going to be able to tell a whole lot about each of us. And so our grandkids are going to be looking at great-grandma's dating profile and sexual preferences, because all that data is going to be out there, and are going to be scrutinizing exactly what that person was doing every day and thinking, and the words that person was using. And over time, the meaning of words, the meaning of actions, the meaning of costumes can change context, can change meaning. And things that, you know, I said in Mexico when I was brought up in a Jesuit school, you know, that my peers thought was fine, that my teachers thought was fine, that the preachers thought were fine, boy, am I glad they're not recorded today.
Yeah.
Because I was taught things that I shouldn't have been taught. And I had to unlearn a lot of things.
How should we, final question, how should we treat people who we vehemently disagree with?
I think you have to look carefully at, is this a person who is such a narcissist or sadist, or who has such anger and lack of empathy and destructiveness inside them that you really have to take that person out and isolate that person and cull that person from the herd? I think listening to people and understanding where they're coming from is incredibly important. Because the way you were brought up, the way I was brought up, I would have been a very different person if I had not been exposed to the US, an international, you know, college atmosphere. And I'd been brought up in a conservative, Catholic, closed group. I think I'd be a very different human being. I see it in some of my, you know, grammar school friends. And so when I talk to them, I don't start from the position, you all are evil, nasty, bigoted people that I will never talk to again in my life. I try and understand where they come from. When I go and I teach evolution in some of the most conservative places in the US, first I read what people are believing. I start with their arguments. I try and make their arguments stronger. And then I say, look, let me tell you why there might be a different way of seeing it. But you have to start with understanding, how could somebody so fundamentally believe things that I find abhorrent? And are they doing it from a position of being evil, or are they doing it from a position of, hey, they were brought up in a completely different way, in a completely different environment from what I was brought up in?
It's been a real pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you, Juan.
Well, thank you so much, Jesse. It was a great pleasure.